Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicoast. We're recording today on 420, and this is episode 30. But we're sober. Politicoast is a podcast that explores what's happening in British Columbia and across the country. If you haven't already, make sure to subscribe and leave a review on iTunes or Apple Podcasts or whatever it's calling itself now, and any other place, I guess, tolerable podcasts are found. Of course, make sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter, where we're at PoliticoastPod.
I'm Scott.
And I'm Ian. Let's dive into our first segment, talking over the talking points. This morning, we had the first opportunity to see the three major party leaders sit down with one another. John Horgan, Christy Clark, and Andrew Weaver took part in a radio debate that was also on City TV and YouTube. So it was actually sort of a film debate on News 1130. That's on YouTube, and we shared that earlier. So do go back and watch it if that's your kind of thing. Before we sort of get into how they did, what do you think they were each hoping to get out of today?
Well, Clark needed to, you know, basically make the case that the province is in good hands, we need to stay the course, and basically ride out any of the criticism that was going to be thrown her way. John Horgan basically needed to make the case that the NDP is ready to take over and that the Liberals can't be trusted anymore to continue to run things. And the Greens needed to show that they were ready to be taken seriously as a party and not just one guy.
The thing I'd add to that is I think both John Horgan and Andrew Weaver really just needed to tell British Columbians who they were. One of the big problems the NDP has had so far is no one knows who John Horgan is. And this is this sort of like test run. I think more people are going to watch next week's televised debate than this sort of radio one.
Yeah, and that's definitely the case. For all the politicians love to talk about jobs, you know, some of us actually have them, and they put the debate at a time where, you know, most people were at work, and I had to listen to it on my commute home, but it's hardly the sort of thing that, you know, a lot of people are going to be tuning into at 8:30 in the morning.
Yeah, I listened to half when I got up this morning when I was in Victoria, sort of on my way to the interview we'll play a bit later in this episode. And then the other half I watched, like, waiting for my flight back to Vancouver. So at least they did make it convenient to see later. But yeah, you're right. It wasn't a, like, catch the widest audience. They maybe hoped to get a few people on their rush hour commute. But who really wants to listen to a leader's debate during their rush hour commute? That I feel like just sort of rises the road rage level a little bit more. But if that was what each of them were hoping to do, how do you think each of them met their targets in those goals?
Well, I actually think Christy Clark came out of this looking the best and really kind of hit the mark she needed to. And the other two, well, didn't. Andrew Weaver, you know, it would have helped if he actually spoke a little more often, because there were long stretches where I kind of forgot he was in the debate because he was just kind of letting the other two go at it and not interjecting or really kind of putting his points forward.
Even in the YouTube version of it, the camera actually like panned in just on Christy Clark and John Horgan for big chunks of it. And so they like literally pushed the moderator, Bill Good, and Andrew Weaver out of frame, and it was just like these two up against each other. So I don't think that was just on the audio version. It was just as apparent in the video. I definitely agree. Andrew Weaver, I think, needed to be a bit more forthright, but where he needed to speak up more, John Horgan maybe needed to pull it back a couple notches, particularly in the first half, where I think he knew that he needed to be more feisty than like the Tom Mulcair or Adrian Dix of the previous NDP campaigns, where they were just too nice and they tried to put on these positive campaigns.
But this was a hard overcorrection on that. I'm not sure he let Christy Clark get a single talking point in without interrupting her. And there were a few really kind of just out of touch and kind of nasty things that... Maybe nasty isn't the right word, but definitely kind of very harsh in how he approached a lot of those stuff.
At one point, he tried to compare her claims to like Sean Spicer and Alternative Facts. And I think he was going for like a, you know, quippy little bit, but it just didn't really land for me. And I'm the sympathizer.
Yeah, that part not landing. Yeah, I mean, politicians sometimes try to hit those marks. Like, remember the trumped up trickle down, that terrible docking point that Clinton must have rehearsed a dozen times and just absolutely failed to land.
We don't get a hashtag fail very often. Yeah.
But there were other points that I think Horden just didn't come off looking good on. Probably the biggest one that stuck out was the moment when he suggested that Christy Clark should read something sometime. Doesn't quite hit the math is hard, but it's kind of just a step below there. And it, you know, came across incredibly patronizing. And I actually a little surprised that it hasn't garnered more outrage. Like, if this was a center-right male politician saying that against the center-left female politician, I'm sure there'd be like two news cycles worth of dissecting that.
I definitely checked in on the hashtags on Twitter, I guess, your votes 2017, for whatever reason. Whatever reason News 1130 chose that one instead of just going to the defaults. I think BC ELX 17 and BC Poly. But the BC Liberal partisans, the hyper-partisans, the staffers, they were playing up the mansplaining, the sexism. And I guess this was even put to Christy Clark right after the debate. And like, did you feel like he was mansplaining to you? Because your staffers were all saying that on Twitter. And she went, the John Horgan we saw tonight was the one I've been seeing for a few years, or something to that effect. Like, not saying yes, but not saying no. And I think what I read was she was basically trying to sort of goad him. She, through the legislature, knows his temper and knows what it takes to sort of rile him up. And she came across very like calm and cool through the whole thing. And it's not that I think he got angry. He just like talked at the same level, but over her so much and just kept interjecting. And she just kind of sat there and kept making her point, which then starts to look better for her than for him.
Yeah, I basically agree with that. That the the level that John Horden interrupted and just came across looking like a jackass more than anything else. Like, there's a point where you can be that kind of passionate, go to, you know, scrappy, looking for a fight sort of thing, where you kind of interrupt a bit and it comes off like making you look good as the kind of, like I said, scrappy fighter guy who's, you know, going to stand up for what he believes in. But there's a point past that where you're just an asshole, and I think he kind of moved into that territory.
I think because I watched it in the sort of two halves, the first being the moderator questions and the second half being the audience questions, I saw it almost in two different styles. And I think the latter half, he did sort of reel it back a bit. And there were a couple exchanges where Christy Clark sort of jumped up over him a little bit more. It still, I think, leaned a bit to Horgan speaking up. And he had the challenge this morning of getting his voice out there, getting known, making the case that the Liberals need to go. But if what people hear, and especially with all the follow-up talk, which would probably be on just this subject, it comes down to Horgan's that angry man who, what is he, like, he got to talk a bit about his policies, but
I think the takeaway was more about his personality than his policies. And just to hit a couple other points that I think he really kind of missed the boat on was the fentanyl question. Actually, that was probably Clark's strongest moment in it, because she really came off looking very empathetic and concerned and everything about it.
Well, you had Andrew Weaver start that sort of exchange off, as far as I remember it, praising Health Minister Todd Stone for his sort of leadership on approaching it from a sort of public health and a harm reduction strategy, which there's cross-partisan support for, thankfully. So Weaver makes the compliments to him. John Horgan sort of follows it up with, yeah, congrats to him. And then Christy Clark is about to say, well, thank you both for the compliments to him, and I agree we should go forward. And she starts talking about her kids and why she wants to sort of solve drug crisis for them. But then Horgan jumps on her for, like, making it politics.
Basically almost attack Clark for talking about caring about her kids on the issue, and it just looked kind of out of touch and nasty, I guess.
Well, especially when it came just off the heels of like a nice sort of good moment where they all sort of agreed on something and had a good positive. And then he's just like, no.
And then just a little while later, when Clark was highlighting the work the health minister had done again, he came in and said this isn't about...
It's not about you. It's always about politics for with you.
Yeah. It's and this should be about the people. Never mind the fact that she was talking about a person in this. And yeah, it just looked like he couldn't let even the slightest positive thing go without jumping in on it. And especially on something like this where, like, you know, like you said, everyone is basically agreeing that the health minister had done some good work on this.
Well, so they talked about fentanyl, and they talked about actually quite a few policies. One thing we saw come up was road tolls. We saw Christy Clark sort of go after Horgan's get rid of the tolls plan for calling it unaffordable, although no one really pushed on her where the money to cover that was. She attacked the NDP quite a bit for, you know, how are you going to pay for that? And when she pointed out the NDP plan to cut the MSPs would shift those tax burdens elsewhere, she sort of just said, yeah, we're just not going to make as much money. We're just going to have less revenue to spend. The sort of, I guess, conservative side of, like, shrink government. And, you know, those were more exchanges where Andrew Weaver sat on the sidelines.
Yeah, and he definitely should have jumped in a little more there, though. From a how to actually debate effectively point, I think those were some of Clark's stronger moments, because she always kept tying it back to that same message of, you know, strong economy. We can afford these because the economy is just so great. And it just, that point kept getting hammered home again and again. And it, in terms of the most polished debater on the stage, it was definitely Clark, because even when it was a bit of a stretch, she fairly seamlessly tied it into the main message she was trying to get across. And between road tolls, between MSP cuts, everything, it always tied back to that one thing. And I think that from a political performance point of view was a very solid win for Clark.
I think Weaver had a really good opening statement and sort of closing statement. And in there were a few good moments for him that sort of countered that narrative. He actually tried to make the argument in there, you know, we need to focus on more than GDP, which is a fairly common argument in people's support.
I think that was actually one of his stronger moments during the debate itself.
But that is a wonky kind of argument to get into the middle of a sort of quip battle between the others. But I think he did manage it, and full credit to Professor Weaver for that.
Yeah, and he did a fairly effective job of tying that into kind of people's day-to-day experiences rather than a argument over whether GDP is actually the best measure. He started with that and led off into something that connects a little better with people.
And then on other policy sides, Clark also kept falling back on this line about the NDP going to drain your children's inheritance or their savings account because the NDP will spend the $500 million in the prosperity fund.
And that was actually another spot where I think Weaver probably did the better job of attacking the point behind that. And he leveled a much more effective criticism on it in terms of where the revenue come from and all of that than John Horgan's just interrupting every time trying to attack it. Like, when he actually did get a chance to speak, Weaver, yeah, laid out a solid case on why that isn't it. And in the end, he came across, I think, looking a lot better, if only there was more chances where he could, or where he would have said something.
Yeah, if you only listen to the debate, you really can't appreciate how much Weaver avoided jumping in, because there were moments when I saw him put up his hand. And just, it's adorable when you see a grown man put up his hand waiting to speak while two other people are yelling at each other. But credit to Andrew Weaver for being, you know, the beacon of politeness at the table. But overall, it was a debate. We actually did see some sparring, and aside from Weaver sort of sitting in the corner, Clark definitely made her polished pitch that when people say she is a good campaigner, this is the sort of thing they're talking about. She knows how to handle these situations, and she knows how to really come off well, even if people generally really dislike her. And there are definitely people who thought she did terrible because they think everything she does is terrible. And there will be people who think John Horgan should have gone even more on the attack because Clark was still breathing after it. But overall, if I think John Horgan can sort of wheel it back a bit in the next debate and Andrew Weaver can almost turn it up a bit, we could have a much more balanced and more enjoyable, potentially, debate, something that's not so awkward at times when Horgan keeps talking over Christy Clark.
Yeah, there's a middle ground between being too forceful and being too meek, and Clark more or less actually hit that point pretty well. And in addition to what you said about that, I'd also just add she did a very effective job at defense on this. You know, being the sitting premier, especially for a party that's been in power for 16 years, this is a lot to attack. And she did a good job of not letting the attacks trip her up or anything. And there's definitely some arguments to be made about some of the points she raised in those defenses, but she presented a decent case and a convincing one to anyone who hasn't followed politics super closely, that most of this stuff was, you know, she presented a reasonable case for it on the defense as well as fairly solid offense on that. So overall, I think the winner has to be Clark on this one. But yeah, if the other two can shape up their performance a bit, the next debate, which people might actually watch just at a decent time, has a chance to be a lot more influential, I think.
Right. So Andrew Weaver was hoping to get greater exposure through this to sort of build upon the prominence of the Green Party at this point. They've been getting quite a bit of press that they never had in a previous election, and their poll numbers are reflecting that. They've had polls come out where they're in first place on Vancouver Island, and parts of Vancouver Island feel like it. I talked to people in Victoria Beacon Hill, which is Carol James's cemented NDP riding. Like, it's been orange for decades. And it's not that people are tired of her. People still like her as an MLA, but they're saying, what about these sort of optimistic people? Kaelin was a great guy who I spoke to, and you'll hear from him later, but I still don't think he'll win. But other ridings are up for grabs in
North,
there.
Exactly. Which is part of what forms Elizabeth May's federal riding, is looking like it's probably going to go green.
And so there's a number of those ridings across the island. And perhaps Andrew Weaver missed a little bit of an opportunity here by not being a little bit more forceful, but...
I think that's probably a fair criticism of him. And I think anyone who's like tried to dispassionately look at it, probably, you know, if you could just isolate the points where he talked, he came across looking the best. But in terms of the bigger picture, he didn't really nail what he needed to.
For sure. But on the Green Party, they've released a couple more planks of their platform in advance of the full document coming out on Monday before next week's major debate.
And yeah, you know, props to them for, you know, in terms of just a campaign strategy of doling it out rather than releasing it, because, you know, it's getting a lot of continuous coverage over the whole course of this, and it's been fairly effective, especially for a party that needs the press more than the others. We've actually probably spent more time on their platform than the other two combined, simply because they are rolling it out piecemeal.
Well, and this was the strategy that really put Maxime Bernier on the map of the Conservative leadership campaign, because he trickled out so many trickle-down economic platforms in those first couple months when people were still like, oh, he's just going to be the fringe libertarian candidate, and now he's front runner. This isn't as long of a campaign, so it's tough for the Greens to get the prominence, but it is a tried and tested strategy, and I'm actually surprised the Liberals and NDP both just like drop platforms in the first week of the campaign.
Yeah, especially the way modern communications work, it would seem to be a much better approach just to trickle them out over the course of a campaign and release the final platform 2-3 weeks into it.
As far as I remember, the last federal campaign, most of the parties only put out their platforms in like the last week, and that was a long campaign. And so we have much more meat to dig into as a podcast, so props to them, and I guess to the Greens as well for giving us a different way to look at it. But let's look at their transportation platform first. In it, they've promised a bunch more money, because one of the, I guess, core ideas of being a green environmentalist is you want public transit to reduce greenhouse gases from cars. So they're going to put $25 million per year for frequency and affordability of public transit fares. We're going to put $125 million in capital expenditures to match some of the federal money. They're going to look at mobility pricing, which means congestion charges and tolls. And this is in direct contrast to the Liberals and NDP, who are both looking at either capping or abolishing tolls. And we heard this come up in the debate. And Andrew Weaver in the debate made this sort of very quick pitch he could for congestion pricing.
And did a good job of it, too. I mean, I'm naturally sympathetic to the argument, but for a rather wonky bit of policy, he made a decent pitch for it. And, it's, you know, like we keep saying, it's a little too bad he didn't say more, but another strong point on that. And, you know, when, like we said, when he spoke, he did well. But, yeah, he did a good job pitching it in the debate, and as has the Green Party in the platform here. Interestingly, I'm not sure which came out first, his position during the debate or the platform, because they both happened this morning.
It might have been one of those cases, like we were talking about earlier, where he said it in the debate and the communication staff were like, shit, let's get it out, because now it's public. But we could always ask Ryan about that, I guess. Or he'll hear this and tweet us.
Definitely props to them for looking at mobility pricing on this. And, you know, between this and some of the stuff on the housing affordability, like they're looking at a pretty serious bunch of policies that aren't just the easy populist, you know, we're going to make things cheaper or easier for people, but, you know, actually do the hard work of trying to implement policies that solve the problem.
And just to round out the transportation platform, they're also going to lean really heavily on the Metro Vancouver mayor's 10-year plan, which is also what the NDP talked about in the debate. But that means not having a giant bridge to replace the George Massey Tunnel, probably twinning it instead. And interestingly, it's also going to renationalize BC Ferries. Right now, it's this more arm's length body. They're just going to bring it back in and do a full review of it. And I guess that'll probably lead to those discussions that Lindsay Tedds was talking with us earlier this week about the importance of just actually deciding whether the ferries are part of the roads or not. And I think the answer almost has to be yes for a lot of communities, because that's the only way to get there. But that will bring up some fear-mongering, I guess, about the Greens' plans to nationalize everything. But I guess I'm glad to see someone's willing to talk about nationalization.
Yeah, not a fan of it myself, but, you know, the ferries are basically arguably one of those things that there's the strongest case for to be run by the government, like basically any other natural monopoly. It doesn't make a huge amount of sense to privatize it in the first place. The thing about the bridge, though, struck me as a little odd. The 10-lane thing, yeah, it's ridiculous overkill, but you know, there's solid reasons why you'd want a bridge rather than a tunnel, because not only is there shipping issues surrounding there, and the tunnel currently limits the draft of ships that can get to the port facilities upriver, where a bridge would not. So that's going to improve the economy if we can actually get increased shipping traffic to the various port facilities. And the other thing is, yeah, Christy Clark is absolutely right when she raised the point in the debate that the tunnel is not seismically up to code anymore. So how does a twinning tunnel solve that? Okay, now only 4 of the 8 lanes are going to have people killed in them when the big one hits? Like, it just doesn't make a huge amount of sense for that. And I just don't see how it's a viable approach to solving it unless they're completely tearing out the tunnel. There's definitely problems with the current Massey Tunnel replacement, but the green solution to it doesn't seem very feasible. The other thing that I noticed on their transportation platform was, among some of the incentives for electric vehicles, is go to free parking, for example, which also doesn't seem a great idea, because you have, okay, yeah, sure, you incentivize electric cars, but parking itself creates a whole bunch of externalities, and low-tar parking encourages people to drive more, and even electric cars are more energy-intensive than, say, an electric trolley bus that we have in the city of Vancouver here for transit. Plus, it takes up a whole bunch of space. There's congestion. It will factor into that if you have free parking at the end. It encourages congestion. And there's just a whole bunch of costs associated with free parking. So that struck me as a little incongruous with the rest of their transportation platform. So other than the questionable aspects of the Massey Tunnel and parking incentives for electric cars, overall I think it's a pretty solid transportation platform on their part, especially the part about the road tolls, which, you know, gone on at length about how crappy the other party's platforms are on the issue. But yeah, this is a solid bit of policy that isn't necessarily the easiest to sell or the most popular. So, you know, good on them for taking the right approach rather than the populist approach.
Well, the Greens have also been very busy this week. They've also released sort of extra details on their democratic reform and their housing platforms, which we had talked about previously. They also put out a health platform, and some of that was touched on in the debate, the idea that they will have a particular ministry responsible for mental health. This is something the NDP talked about as well, and is just a way to really bring attention to the importance of mental health, both addictions, but also just depression and anxiety and more serious issues as well. The Greens will also look at putting more money in nutrition and wellness programs in schools. They'll work to expand primary care by physiotherapists, nurse practitioners, midwives, implement an essential drugs program, and also do a bit more for seniors. So sort of ambitious platform with the focus on mental health, I think, being a really positive thing that, again, is sort of a cross-partisan good idea at this point.
So unfortunately, the party platform's a little vague on the specifics of what that essential drug program is. It gives three bullet points that basically tell you nothing. And unlike some of the other platform things, they don't have a nice long PDF background to link to either. So
it's still a 12-page document on the health plan, to be fair. Comparing that to, I think the entire NDP platform was 20, 30 pages, and the Liberals about the same. So this is one plank of the Greens. The Greens, are, if anything, are policy wonks.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I'm just saying it's disappointing that this thing that we're both a little questioning on the details of doesn't well have more details.
Because one thing I would personally want to see is a pitch for a pharmacare plan. Like, if we're going to have socialized medicine, drugs are now part of our socialized medicine, but they're not officially. And so it becomes really hard to afford a lot of drugs. When I lived in the UK for 2 years, every prescription was £8, whether it actually cost you £2 or more. If it costs less, the doctors usually told you to just ask for it over the counter. But this meant ridiculously expensive drugs were affordable to the average person, because the government subsidized a lot of them and bulk-buyed. There's sort of thoughts about talking about doing it within the NDP at times and maybe the Liberals, but no one's being that ambitious. And instead, we have the Greens here talking about drugs are unaffordable, and everyone acknowledges this, but we should have an initiative to, quote, provide an evidence-based integrated roadmap that will ensure British Columbians can get essential pharmaceutical drugs they require in order to treat health conditions, which...
Okay, so what does that mean?
Yeah, that's the, like, intro to a plan, but I guess they're planning to have a plan to deal with drug prices. At least they acknowledge it's an issue and that their response will be evidence-based. But otherwise, I think the Greens have a solid health plan here. The other plan that the BC Greens released in this last week was their natural resources strategy. And this is another big wonky document that the Greens have, but people have sort of wondered, how are the Greens going to balance their efforts to promote green jobs with, will they protect resource extraction, which BC relies a lot on, the BC economy relies a lot on resources. A big chunk of this plan really revolves around beefing up the environmental assessments that go into things. The Greens have been very critical of the federal Liberals, the provincial Liberals, for both sort of using the Harper government gutted environmental assessment processes while promising to fix them, but then just sort of sticking with them. And so they would want to see this be re-enhanced. They also talk about making sure they work with Indigenous people and First Nations groups in consultation on any of these projects. They also have a big section of their natural resources just on forestry. And so they want to make sure we, of course, protect old growth forests. They've talked about cutting the PST from purchasing machinery for upgrading sawmills. So they're not anti-forestry industry. If anything, I think they want to talk about processing softwood lumber in BC rather than having to continue to fight trade deals with the US.
Yeah, like the NDP, they do seem to be leaning a bit heavy on the raw log at sports as a point of contention and something they want to reduce, which I always started as a little more of an ideological commitment to, you know, value-added jobs are better than other jobs rather than a what makes the most economic sense. And if it, you know, makes the most economic sense to extract here and do another part of the processing somewhere else, well, that's part of why trade is beneficial, is it allows everyone to specialize in what they do best rather than trying to work at doing everything in one place.
I think the only other thing to really note in the Green Party's natural resources is what's almost not in there. And what they barely mention at all is oil and natural gas. I think the only like major mention they talk about is reforming the BC Oil and Gas Commission to make sure that it's not heavily influenced as, or not as heavily influenced by oil and gas companies. They're very critical of the quote, get to yes climate that the liberals, they say, engage in. But beyond that, you sort of, if you read between the lines, you can get the sense and you just sort of listen to Green Party rhetoric. They're not the pro-oil and gas party. And I think they avoided almost saying anything in it just to avoid the direct criticism. But if you vote for the Greens, you know what you're getting. So the criticism on them is going to come should the Liberals choose to levy it. Of course, the Liberals, to some extent, might not want to really go after the Greens because the Greens might be splitting votes with the NDP at different times.
Yeah, the only other thing that strikes me on this is point 19, that a BC Green government will work with professional associations and local government to ensure the design of stormwater, wastewater, and drinking water infrastructure accounts for the risk of climate change. But, you know, they don't actually provide any details there, and I'd be really curious to see what it is, because this is something that does get taken into account in current design of stormwater systems. So I'm a little curious on what their changes they want to make here. And so, unfortunately, they don't actually provide anything. But that might just be because this is something that I know a bit about professionally. And that, so that little bit strikes me as just should be there, but isn't. And that might be more my own wonkiness than anything else.
A lot of the points in this plank specifically are enhance the reviews or review the reviews that we're doing or just sort of try to bring more science and evidence to things. They're not like specific, we're going to put this much money here or take this much money out of this or lean on this industry or not lean on that industry. It's just, let's look at how this is being done and make it more green, I guess, both big G and little g. But we'll look forward next week to the full BC Green platform coming out, at which point they'll have their costs, which I guess are costed over 4 years, as Andrew Weaver said in the debate, which when he said, I almost wondered, does that mean he's going to run a deficit for 2 years and pay for it with surpluses in the final 2 years? Or was it just he meant each year is going to be balanced?
Well, the other reading of that is that there's a massive budget hole in year five, but somehow I don't think that's what he meant.
Well, the carbon tax will be $300 a ton by then, and you don't need to worry about anything. And if you notice during the debate, he also talked about how much money we're going to make off pot, which every other politician kind of stays away from. So if you want to make a lot of money off pot, maybe the Greens are the way to go. And he did talk about making sure pot is as much of a craft industry as the craft beer and not having the Labatt's Blue and Molson Canadian of the cannabis industry.
Yeah, not really a pot guy, but I do appreciate the entrepreneurial support in that part of his debate answer.
Well, just to close off our section that's gone a little bit long, but it's midst of an election, let's just take a quick look at where the state of the race is. The sort of place I always fall back on is Eric Grenier's poll analysis. He's now doing that on CBC. His model averages polls in a similar way to 538, except he has much less data because we only get polls every few days in Canada instead of every couple hours or more. Nevertheless, the NDP is still in the lead with about 41% to the Liberals about 38%, but the Greens are sitting at a comfortable 20% province-wide. A couple polls have put them in first place on the island, but it seems like it's a tight three-way race there. And what's so encouraging to me is the others, which includes the BC Conservatives, have all now fallen to 1.3%, which feels much more realistic than the 10% the Conservatives were sitting at in the pre-election polls.
Yeah, well, part of that, too, is now that the nomination period's officially closed as of Tuesday, we know that the BC Conservatives are only running, I believe, 6 candidates?
And we heard earlier this week that the Libertarians are hoping to run in the 30s, and even the Your Political Party are looking to run 9 candidates. So there's a high chance the Libertarians are going to be the fourth party in this election.
Yes, and not only that, because they're only in a few ridings, the pollsters are dropping them from their sampling too. So you can expect to see them get grouped in with others.
And Eric Grenier projects, based on those poll numbers, the NDP will probably average about 44 on our election today, but that could swing from as low as 30 to as high as 60. The Liberals, meanwhile, have the 80% confident range of 24 to 51. So there's a lot of overlap. And if this election is as unpredictable as the last BC election, it's just going to, it could easily be another Liberal majority from just people staying home and the right people showing up. The Greens are probably feeling good because their low right now is 2, and their high is 10 to 14, potentially, with the sort of average around 4. Basically, any gain for the Greens is going to be a win for them, and unless things completely collapse on the island, they're going to be doing really well. It really remains to be seen whether they can break through outside of Vancouver Island, though. They may start to get competitive in some Metro Van ridings, but
I believe they're doing fairly well in New Westminster, but yeah, for the most part, their main base of support appears to be the island, and it's unlikely that they're going to see a big breakthrough absent some sort of big NDP blow-up.
Which may have been what John Horgan just did this morning, but it'll take a few days for us to really figure that out.
I don't think this debate performance is going to sing him, but it didn't help. But yeah, just one other note, Too Close to Call, another Canadian poll aggregator, more or less puts in the same range. As the NDP has slightly less of a vote share, but a slightly more efficient vote, coming in at an expected 47 seats to, compared to the Eric Grenier's 44, but and slightly more pessimistic on the Greens and Liberals. But by and large, the consensus appears to be at this moment, with now we're still a couple weeks out, appears to be around a NDP victory. But, you know, it's the NDP. They've snatched defeat from the jaws of victory before. Moving on to segment 2, winning the housing market. Kathleen Wynne, Premier of Ontario, just released a whole bunch of housing policies, more or less aping the BC Liberals with, you know, rent control, which we touched on a bit when it looked like they were going to announce it a few weeks back. So big thing is they're bringing a 15% tax on home purchases by non-resident foreigners in Toronto and the Golden Horseshoe, basically the GTA plus Hamilton. In addition to that, they're bringing in rent control on rental units built after 1991, go back a couple episodes to listen to kind of our take on that. But, you know, we had a few criticisms on whether or not that was a good idea. Mostly settled on it wasn't. Interestingly, they're also looking at rebating the cost of development charges for building of rental houses, which strikes me as a slightly worse option than just trying to lower the cost of building in general. But, you know, that's more or less seems to be the Ontario Liberals' approach to stuff is,
I think maybe it's trying to give a targeted,
yeah,
and really push for rentals. So I get the idea of it. I don't know if
but it's, but Canadian tax policy and everything is so focused on subsidizing home ownership that, you know, maybe saving a little money there might, and leveling the playing field at the same time, it might be a little easier to, or a little better to do. Maybe not politically easier, but definitely better policy. And they're also granting Toronto and other municipalities the ability to bring in vacant housing taxes, kind of like the BC government did here. Also looking to bring more provincial land into use for housing. It's like more or less it's BC's recent policies with a little rent control thrown in. So all this is interesting, but it also comes on the heels of a couple stories out of Vancouver here that's basically showing housing prices are, you know, picking up again after the bit of a slump and a slight slowdown in the rate of housing sales in the Metro Vancouver area. And we aren't quite at the 2016 high yet, but the uncertainty that came in after the very rapid implementation of the foreign buyers tax more or less seems to have shaken itself out. And, you know, housing prices are back on the upwards climb. So it kind of raises the question on whether or not these policies are actually going to work.
Well, we've seen Justin Trudeau and the federal Liberals actually start to talk about housing now that it's affecting Toronto. Never minding that, you know, we've been arguing and fighting over it for a couple of years now and trying to throw up the alarms.
As much as, you know, as a Westerner, I'll take a shot at Ottawa for only caring about stuff when Toronto gets involved. In all fairness, there isn't a huge amount the federal government can do, and they've been slowly tightening the rules around mortgages anyway. So Justin Trudeau, yeah, he's making a big deal out of it now that Ontario is getting affected, but like policy-wise, I doubt much is going to change at the federal level. Right now, we're kind of in the spring buy-in season, and you know it's still fairly high by historical standards. Not peak, but high. Well, and so it makes you wonder if these tax policies are actually doing anything really at all.
It sort of puts a big question mark beside the pitches the provincial parties are all making. I mean, the Greens are talking about expanding the foreign buyers tax and raising it, but if it didn't work, why would it work at a higher rate other than to just really upset more people and make...
Well, it depends how elastic demand is with price, which hasn't been particularly evident so far. But to the Greens' credit, they're also more than the other party seriously looking at the other kind of supply issues surrounding it. And, you know, they were the only party that identified zoning restrictions as a contributing factor to housing unaffordability. So while their plan is a little more tax heavy than I'd like, it's well balanced with some of the other aspects of it, better so than the rest of the provincial parties.
And if the weather gets nicer, we'll just have to see how much higher the house prices go, because I mean, it was a nice day today, but we've had a lot of rain this spring and a lot of cloudy days, which doesn't put Vancouver in the best sort of house buying mood. When it's sunny and flowers are blooming and cherry blossoms are everywhere, I could probably bet people could sell condos for 10-15% more just because you go, wow. But prices are still going up, and it really puts the challenge out there to try and pitch something that will actually help. And I'm not sure the BC Liberals have it up their sleeve.
Or the Ontario Liberals, for that matter, too. And besides importing a bunch of policies that at best have made Vancouver go from extremely unsustainable price growth to just very unsustainable price growth, and then thrown in, you know, rent control, but also trying to throw some more subsidies at developers to do rent, which really does seem to be the Ontario Liberals' approach to government of throw up all these barriers, then throw subsidies at big companies to help them do the thing you want them to after you put all the barriers in. We're going to have to watch what's happening in Toronto, but a little pessimistic that it's going to really change much.
Well, and for a third quick segment, anarchy in the UK, for lack of a better name at this point, Theresa May on Monday dropped a surprise, hey, let's have an election announcement. The UK, being a Westminster system, they can call elections anytime they want, except they sort of moved to a fixed election date system a few years ago. Only they can trigger an early election if they get 2/3 of the votes in the House or lose a confidence motion. And the Conservatives, having a majority government, actually managed to talk everyone into having an election for some reason. The sort of argument she's pitching is the Conservatives don't have enough of a majority to push through the Brexit she wants. which she didn't even really want earlier.
Well, I think it's more that they don't have a mandate. They have the majority, but they haven't got a mandate from the people to push through their interpretation of Brexit.
And from what I saw in my British friends, it was a very strong, like, it's time for the opposition to end to Brexit. Like, she just wants... Basically, what it really comes down to is the Conservatives are up by over 20 points in the polls over Labour and everyone else. And if she wins that big of a vote in the Commons right now, she can take the 330 out of 650 seats she has and probably turn it into 400 or something absurd and just crush everyone else. Being a first-past-the-post country, she can sweep England, let Scotland go to the SNP, let Ireland and Wales go to the parties that we don't even really understand what they stand for, but we have their acronyms in front of us. Like, I honestly couldn't tell you what the difference between the SDLP, the UUP, Sinn Féin, and Plaid Cymru are. And so this is a very opportunistic election that's coming up, and it'll be in June. And Labour's just been struggling for a long time, going into Brexit and going into the last election. Basically, right after the last UK election, Ed Miliband stepped down after Labour lost, after they were hoping to beat the Conservatives, who were previously in a coalition with the Liberal Democrats. And instead, the Conservatives surprised everyone with a majority government, but it was a narrow majority government. Jeremy Corbyn, the sort of Bernie Sanders of the UK, only... I don't even know if that's true, because Bernie never had to go to the whole electorate. And so I think almost if Bernie had hit the top, he wouldn't have had the sort of 50-50 support. There would have been such negative attacks on him that it might have pushed him into these levels, but it's hard to tell. Basically, what's happened with Corbyn is he's got a very strong core base of supporters who now essentially are in charge of Labour, where there used to be the sort of New Labour, Tony Blair, centrist.
And that still represents a good chunk of the caucus.
Yeah, so the party members really don't like Jeremy Corbyn, who has mostly sat in the back benches and been the disgruntled socialist, and now he's the leader. And so right after the election, he won the leadership, and then it came into Brexit, and he didn't really push very hard on the yes side. He didn't really push hard on the no side. He really annoyed a lot of people.
Yeah, and there was even suspicion that he might have voted leave. Like, the man's been a Eurosceptic for a long time, opposed the original signing of the treaty that created the EU, like, as just not being a fan of the EU, basically sees it as...
A neoliberal attempt to push austerity on everyone.
Yes.
Like, he comes at it from the sort of left-wing attack rather than the UKIP racist xenophobic right-wing attack.
Yeah, and if he was to become prime minister, you know, there's a lot of the sort of policies he wants to do that he wouldn't be allowed to do under EU rule. So, like, there's always been a suspicion that, Brexit wasn't the worst thing in the world as far as he was concerned.
And so shortly after the Brexit vote in June of last year, there was a push to oust him as leader, and that was basically his caucus, like, getting together and trying to stab him in the back. And the membership, or his supporters of the membership, really revolted, and he almost, like, further cemented his position, and he sort of had to purge his shadow cabinet to find more the few loyalists he had.
Didn't he also have a lot of just resignations from the shadow cabinet? Like, he couldn't keep shadow ministers around?
I mean, six of one, half dozen of the other, like, whether they went voluntarily or not, it didn't work out for anyone. And since then, it's just kind of been a trickling away of Labour support. Like, in March, April of last year, they were closing in on neck and neck with the Conservatives. But Brexit has almost, like, put the wind in the sails of the Conservatives. Also, there was a 5 to 10 point drop in UKIP support since then, so arguably, UKIP lost its raison d'etre, and they all just went to the Conservatives, who are now leading the Brexit charge. And now Labour is sitting at 25% support in the UK, And the conservatives are sitting around 45% to 50%. Yeah,
and I think this really shows what a massive error it was on the part of the Labour Party to pick Corbyn as a... they're just, like, in this climate where there's, like, you know, there's starting to be some regrets among some of the Brexiters, and there's, you know, that kind of core kind of left... Not even just left, because there are a lot of, like, centre-right people who didn't want Brexit to happen, but there's a significant anti-Brexit sentiment that at least half the population, if they had, like, a solid person to rally around who could make a viable case, they could win an election.
But no one in Labour has really pushed that message. And if the most pro-EU party right now are the Liberal Democrats, and since the election, they've been effectively non-existent. They've dropped below 10% in the polls for a long time and have only recently just gotten to that. They're sitting at like Green Party level of support. They're below UKIP.
But that's kind of just the problem here is that despite the fact that Brexit is significantly unpopular in a huge chunk of the UK population, there's just no easy spot for them to all rally around because, you know, I think most people rightly don't trust Corbyn on the issue. And then, you know, the Lib Dems are those guys who are also on the ballot, but maybe they'll surprise everyone during the campaign, but... there just isn't a good spot for that kind of sentiment to rally around and, you know, actually provide a viable check on Brexit.
Tim Farron, who's leading the Lib Dems, is just not charismatic enough, it seems. And there's questions about how liberal he is, because I guess he is an evangelical Christian who's had some more like pro-life stances that set a lot of Liberal Democrats ill at ease. Corbyn arguably has more persona than him. He's a bigger politician, bigger figure, but is that sort of polarizing? All I can say for sure is that Nicola Sturgeon and the Scottish National Party is just going to sweep most of the Scottish seats, and probably with a very much with an even stronger presence than they had, which they won in the last election 56 of the seats in Scotland. They lost 2 through resignations through the parliament to get down to 54, but there's a good chance that as Article 50 rolls through, however it works, Scotland's going to keep bringing up their want for another referendum, particularly if the Conservatives return with a English-dominated majority mandate.
Yeah, and with how prominent you get to stay in the EU, that is kind of a question if you go independent whether or not you're going to get... you automatically come along. Like, that's part of the reason the Scottish independence referendum didn't hit that support. And, you know, now that things are kind of going the other way, there's a good chance Scotland splits off should the SNP, you know, win a majority, which in Scotland, which they almost certainly will, and Brexit happens.
And I'll just touch, I guess, finally on the Green Party, who do exist in Britain. I believe they have one member of parliament in Brighton, which is the... let's call it the Tofino of England. It's the hippie town on the coast where you would expect a Green Member of Parliament to exist. England has the same issue with First Past the Post as Canada. The Greens aren't going to break through anywhere else, even though I believe they are also a pretty strongly pro-EU party. There have actually already been calls from the Greens, though, to have electoral non-competes with the Lib Dems and Labour's party as a way to sort of block a conservative majority. Only everyone's already thrown that out. This would be the idea that wherever the Labour has the best chance, the other parties don't run, and where the Liberal Democrats have the best chance, the other parties don't run. And this has been pitched by Greens in Canada, and Stéphane Dion famously didn't run a Liberal candidate against Elizabeth May, and the Green Party didn't run a candidate against Stéphane Dion in his riding in the 2008 election, I believe it was.
Not that Stéphane Dion was ever at risk of losing his riding.
No, and the Liberals weren't pulling a lot of votes out of there either.
Sandwich Gulf Islands has, before Elizabeth May won it in 2011, had gone solidly either Alliance or Conservative after the merger. So yeah, it was a bit of a change. As a not the most conservative ride in, I mean, it's on Vancouver Island after all, but, you know, it wasn't a place the Liberals had had for quite a while.
So I'll be watching this election closely. I have the right to vote in the UK because of their weird citizens can vote who are living overseas for up to 15 years. And so I get to exercise that through a proxy of a friend who lives in the riding that I last lived in. And to all of our Commonwealth listeners, if you live in the UK or move to the UK, you can potentially vote in the UK.
Do they have a residency requirement? Like here, if even if you're a Canadian citizen in this election, you have to have resided in BC for 6 months.
I believe there might be a residency requirement for Commonwealth citizens, but they still allow Commonwealth citizens to vote, which
right.
is not reciprocal.
Canada isn't going to pack up and move to the UK to win the election.
Could we?
Well, that's what I'm asking.
But realistically, Britain is a silly place that's going to get a lot darker, and I'm sad to see this happening. And the thing is, Labour and the Lib Dems actually could have stopped this election. They could say, no, we're not going to give you the votes you actually need to call the election. It looks a little cynical then, but there's no urgent need. The Conservatives could hold on to power for another 2 years and just try and push it through slower, but
oh, there's still a 2-year time limit on it either way, because of Article 50, but I'm not sure what Labour was thinking, but at least, you know, when Labour's a little ambivalent on, I can see the Lib Dems saying, hey, there's an opportunity here.
And sometimes campaigns matter, so good luck to the pro-Europe forces, and I really am worried. At least UKIP is probably dying.
They can only go down from one seat, so.
So we have that to watch for. We have the French presidential elections coming up as well very soon. And the Conservative Party leadership, I guess, is also having its vote later next month. So there's lots of election news for us to keep following for the next couple months, at least. And finally, earlier today, as I was mentioning, I was in Victoria and I had the chance to interview Kaylin Harris, who's the Green Party's candidate for Victoria Beacon Hill. I spoke with Kaylin a bit about the mechanics of running an election rather than getting more thoughts about the Green Party. And we don't want to be the Greens' voice, but I thought it'd be interesting to get Kaylin's perspective on just what it takes to become a candidate, why he did, and what it's just like running a campaign. So take it away, Kaylin.
Well, my name's Kaylin Harris. I'm the BC Greens candidate in Victoria Beacon Hill.
Well, thanks for sitting down with me, Kaylin. I was hoping to sort of get the insider take on what it actually takes to be a candidate and to run a campaign. So what sort of motivated you to want to get involved in politics? Let's start a bit further back, I guess.
Well, yeah, that is it's a really far way back. When I was a kid, my grandparents used to sit around the afternoon tea table talking about the mayor. And the mayor was not the mayor, it was like Bill. And,
here in Victoria?
Know, no, actually, I grew up in the Lower Mainland, and my dad grew up in Haney, which is now Maple Ridge, right?
Okay.
So yeah, the mayor of Haney was—I'm trying to remember the name exactly—but it was always Bill and Susan and Michael, and you know, not really, you know, either criticizing them or just talking about what it was that they were doing, and it really humanized the political process for me, and so I've always kind of thought that it was strange that we had these kind of mystifying approach to politics and politicians. I always expected that we should be talking about them like they're human beings, because in fact they are. I mean, they're all members of our community. They're all trying to do their job just as the rest of us are. So, I've always been interested in politics and politicians. But when I got through university and started studying politics, the ones that were interested in politics as a profession were people that didn't speak the language that I did. I believed that politics was important for what it could achieve, whereas it seemed that the majority of people that were interested in politics were people who were interested in having their voices heard.
It's sort of power grab, the stereotype that everyone sort of has a negative perception of.
Yeah, I mean, like when you're 21 years old walking around campus with a suit jacket on, I feel like you're missing the point of university, you know?
I'm wearing a suit jacket today, but that's because I have like a bunch of meetings and it's like the only
jacket I brought. So,
are you in university?
No, I'm well graduated now. So,
like again, and you're not 21.
Yeah.
I think when you're in university, I think that's the time to kind of really explore what's being given to you, and you should probably do a lot more listening than you are talking. And so, I always kind of stayed outside of those circles, though. I was always in political science classes and really passionate about the theory and the reasons why we do these things. And it took, 10 years before I got into the position where I owned a small business and I was starting to look at my community in a functional way and seeing the difference that representation can make and on a very grassroots level. A year and a half ago, it was December 2015 when Andrew Weaver was made leader, a little bit earlier than expected, but when he was acclaimed, I was there at the announcement, and I hadn't actually ever met Andrew Weaver before, though I have been a Green supporter for a long time, but I bought my membership to the province then and started to get involved. And so I was the president of the Riding Association here for 6 months and, you know, did some kind of basic fundraising and kind of getting the word out and reaching out into the public. And the more I kind of talked to people, the more people said, you know, you could run, you know, and I always thought, well, I guess I could. It's not necessarily something that I was ever kind of headed towards. But again, the more people I talked to, the more people said, you know what, you've spoken passionately about local politics for the last 5 years in your coffee shop. You might as well actually just get out there and get a bigger audience. And when the process to look at who would be our candidate in Victoria Beacon Hill started, I said, you know what, I will throw my hat in the ring, and I will do it as long as nobody better comes along.
Right,
and so here we are now.
So each party has different rules of what it takes to sort of go from that you should run to you're running.
Yeah.
Maybe just in the brief, but not too wonky. Mm. Like, how many signatures? What was the sort of steps you had to take to?
Well, the BC Greens required a little bit of proof of not wing nuttiness.
Yes, yeah. Every party has that, of course.
So I had to get 100 signatures from around the region. Didn't have to be Victoria Beacon Hill. Just had to be supporters that said that, you know, like you should run for the Greens. We had to come up with a chunk of change. I think it was $2,000. Being a small business owner and my fiance having gone through some health troubles in the last few years, we weren't in the position to just throw $2,000 at the thing. So we had a couple of team members do some groundwork and kind of convince some people that a plucky little coffee shop owner might be a good investment. So,
well, and that kind of getting the support from your supporters, mm-hmm. I think, shows a better connection with the...
Yeah,
future.
And I mean, that's kind of my whole take on this. I mean, one of the conversations that we're having in the riding is a connection to the voters and community engagement. Our incumbent, she's been in and had comfortably in for 12 years.
Carol James.
She was the leader, of course, of the NDP. And she's, and I think with the exception of like two elections, this has been an NDP riding since the 70s. So it's pretty safe spot for her, and I think because of that, she neglected to jump on some really important issues for people, not suggesting that she completely missed the ball or anything, but she certainly wasn't listening when people needed to be heard, and so that it was kind of that that notion that led me to believe like pursue the belief that the democracy needs to be about conversations between representatives and their electorate, and it just wasn't being had. So,
right. Well,
yeah.
So you got the Green Party nod, mm-hmm. then you had to go through the provincial sort of approval for Elections BC.
Right.
What's that sort of process? Because that process is the same for every candidate, whether you're independent or BC Liberal well-funded.
Yeah, and so it was an interesting, a different process because, of course, a lot of my political support and my social support comes from outside of the riding. And so the Elections BC requires that you get 75 signatures from within your riding. Rather than bother my friends with that, I was already knocking on doors. So I just took that around with me. And every time I introduced myself, whether they were a supporter or not, I said, you know, like, would you at least consider having my name on the ballot? Because I think we've had a great conversation here. Mm-hmm. And I hope that you believe that these conversations should be had at a regional level, or at least in the community. And a lot of people just jumped on board. You know, I had a lot of NDP supporters sign my nomination papers.
Yeah, I think there's this sort of misconception that you have to be a Green Party voter to sign your nomination as a Green Party candidate. But what I've sort of found is that, yeah, I'd love to just have you on the ballot just so we can have that debate.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's exactly it. I think a Green Party, I mean, it doesn't matter your support. This is all about election. And, yeah. I think, again, one of those things that I like to talk about is the fact that our democracy started without parties. It was like we have a representative mm-hmm. democracy, which requires that when you're elected, you're the representative of the entire district and the entire region. That's a nonpartisan place. And so that's one of the reasons why I love the Green Party, is because we try to talk to as many people as possible without the bounds of partisanship. And so that's where I was able to start those conversations on the doorstep and say, like, this isn't about party. This is about really robust conversations about the future of our community.
Right. Well, let's jump forward to today, middle of the election campaign. We're sitting here in your campaign office in downtown Victoria, and it's a really nice office, actually.
Yeah,
congrats.
We lucked out.
You're right beside the bank and stuff like that. But walk me through sort of a typical day. You said you have volunteers coming in soon. What are the kind of things you're up to? What are they up to?
Well, because I am a coffee shop owner, and again, it's a small business. This morning I woke up at 6 o'clock. I went down and opened the coffee shop, made a bunch of Americanos and lattes, said hi to my friends, and then once the staff kind of trickle in and get everything kind of underway, then I step away and I come here and start to get things sorted out with the volunteers and kind of put them in different directions. Spend a bunch of time answering media and other special interest organizations that are interested in hearing our position on, you know, the wildlife plans. The natural resource platform plank just came out, so there's all sorts of these types of things. People are making sure that we have a viable childcare plan. These types of things. And so also introducing myself to the community, because there's a lot of people who know who I am as a coffee shop guy. I've been a vocal supporter of Joanne Roberts' federal campaign. Last year I was also an outspoken proponent of Mayor Lisa Helps in the 2014 elections. So people know that I'm politically active, but they don't necessarily know who I am. And so there's a lot of that stuff going back and forth with the newspapers and stuff like that. So that's kind of my mornings. And then my afternoons, we start kind of getting to the phone calls, calling supporters and donors and thanking them for their support and asking if they want signs and see if we can get more volunteers in place. Because being the upstarts in downtown Victoria against a very strong incumbent, we are pretty much on our own doing this. We are lucky in that Andrew Weaver's, our leader's riding is right next door. And so we've got a lot of really goodwill kind of spilling over from his riding. But everybody's focused on making sure he gets elected. And of course, you know, the star power of Dr. Andrew Weaver is a really big draw for volunteers. They want to be in that room. They want to be in that space. But we basically kind of organize our afternoons and our evenings, and I go knock on doors. Like I said, I think the election is about personal connections. Our opponents will tell you that it's that we need the big money to get votes. Well, I'll tell you it's 10 cents worth of a flyer and a knock on a door will mm-hmm. get you just as many votes as any $1 million ad buy. So I guess that's kind of my day. I generally then come back, and right now we've got a few debates coming up. So I'm after 8 o'clock when I stop knocking on doors out of respect for my neighbors. I come back and I do debate prep, and we go over policy and with all the platform planks that are dropping kind of systematically. It's a lot of work and a lot of drilling, and but I'm super lucky. I've got a couple of great volunteers who've come on board and just like promised that by the time I get into any sort of debates that I will be an expert in a Green Party platform. So,
Well, let's walk forward to election day. People have probably heard about the idea of a get out the vote, but I know you haven't run your campaign through the end, but I imagine you are already starting to think about the plan for that day.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, we've been thinking and talking about this for months. It's important to me that regardless of the outcome of this election, that we engage people and that we get as many voters out as possible. And so I've kind of tapped a couple of my coffee shop friends to make sure that we've got an awareness campaign going. In the municipal elections, we stamp cups in our coffee shop, and I'll give a shout out to another local proprietor there, Shane Devereaux of Habit Coffee. And I think by the end of the municipal campaign, we had, I think we had 28 coffee shops stamping cups to just get out the vote, nonpartisan,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And so we hope to do the same thing with this election. So that's an awareness building campaign, but we're also, I mean, we have in the region some talented electoral, I guess, minds that have been kind of pushing us and directing us to make sure that we've got plans in place to make sure that we can get people to the polls and we're identifying our voters and, you know, that standard electioneering stuff. Yeah, like I said, I'll be happy to lose this if we get 100% voter turnout, you know. I suspect that if we do, that I will probably be standing victorious, just simply because people have been so, I don't know, disillusioned by the electoral process and the sniping between parties over the last 20, 30 years, that if we can actually engage them enough to come out and vote, they're probably voting for something different. So that's the big plan, is just try to inspire. We're gonna try to make sure we knock on every door and remind everybody that May 9th's the day, and that we need to have their voices heard.
Well, are you gonna be having a big party here or at your coffee shop on election night, or have you not thought that through yet?
Oh no, the party's already, because of course we're the regional hub on the island and we're doing so well on the island. I think the party's gonna be planning something big downtown here. We were kind of toying around with the idea. We've got a pretty big space here. We had 100 and some odd people here the other day for our office launch. I think it'd be really fun to be a part of. I mean, like, one of the reasons why I love the Greens is that they're all really good people. Every event I've ever been to with them, it's always been a really positive experience. So I'm looking forward to celebrating with my friends and my colleagues. I've become pretty good friends with a lot of my cohorts running on the island here. Mark Neufeld in Saanich South is an inspiration, even though he had a bit of a misstep the other day.
Right.
He's one of those just kind-hearted, caring, loving guys that is in it for all the right reasons again. Dr. Chris Maxwell, same thing in Victoria Swan Lake. And actually Brendan Ralph's over running against John Horgan. He's got an uphill battle, but man, he's willing to do it, and he's knocking on doors and he's having fundraisers and kitchen table talks and all the rest of it, and he's in it to win it as well. So I'm just again inspired by so many of the candidates, and of course, I mean, Sonia Firstenow and Couchin, Andy McKinnon over in Esquimalt Langford, Machosen rather. I heard him. I heard reports from him speaking at the BCSEA, the Sustainable Energy Association's town hall recently, and people came away just being absolutely inspired by his knowledge and his passion. And yeah, like I said, it's just an amazing team. So I'll be really looking forward to celebrating with that team on election day.
Right. Well, I'll let you go quickly. But is there anything else you wanted to get in there? Any priority policies you have that you really want to see come forward? Or?
My coffee shop is located right across the street from our place, which is a low barrier outreach facility. I used to work in child and youth care for the Prince George Native Friendship Center. I was an outdoor educator at a summer camp when I was a teenager and a young adult. The combination of education and mental health are things that I don't know we talk enough about. And the BC Greens have put together an amazing platform, investing a ton of money in education, early childhood education, and mental health care. And we've, I don't know if you've seen but the platform plank on mental health is we're actually proposing a new ministry for responsible.
Yeah, they were talking about that on the debate when I was walking here. Both the NDP and Greens were very happy to agree on that, which was good to hear.
And so that's one that I feel like from addictions as far as depression or addictions as far as the hard stuff, the ones right. the ones that make the news, fentanyl and all the rest of it. But I mean, I'm talking about addictions as far as tobacco and alcohol right. and gambling. Mm-hmm. These are all mental health issues, right? And I think if we and I mean depression is another one that keeps yeah. people out of work a lot of these days, and so. I want to make sure that when people are going to the polls, that they're thinking not just about the dollars and cents aspects of casting their ballot, but also the human element. And that's where, again, being able to trust the Greens and looking at where we get our money from and why we're doing these things and why we're out there every day pounding the pavement. I feel like we definitely deserve the opportunity to earn their trust and earn their vote.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, man. Thanks for coming by.
No problem.
You can follow Kalen on Twitter at @VoteKalenHarris. Kalen is spelled K-A-L-E-N. Or go to his website, kalenharris.com.
And if you're a little annoyed with how much coverage we're getting of the Greens, we'd love to have a BC Liberal on, and we've asked a few times, but got a little pull there. We'd love to get them, and because they haven't been returning our calls or emails so far. So moving on to our quick takes, Trump made a bit of a splash up here this week when it came to our dairy industry. He kind of came out swinging in a big pro-protectionist speech he gave, specifically taking aim at our quote-unquote, very unfair dairy industry.
It comes as somewhat of a surprise, as Trump had previously talked. Trump had talked a lot about rewriting NAFTA or scrapping NAFTA, but as he sort of became president, which still is not normal, let's remember, he sort of walked back the talk on Canada, and he said, look, Canada is an important trading partner, and we're not going to destroy that over this. But now he's had a sort of standard Trump change of heart and is taking hard aim at...
Well, Trump really does seem to take the position of the last person he talked to, and he happened to be in Wisconsin visiting a bunch of dairy farmers, so I'm sure that's where the where he got the idea that Canada has very unfair dairy industry came from, was the Wisconsin farmers. Now, granted, we do have a lot of problems with the dairy industry, and this is one of those few cases where Trump is kind of right about, because, our supply management system is pretty horrible. We have a 300% tariff on dairy products coming in from the States and around the world. So, that's a fair bit of criticisms on that. Our dairy industry is, massively protected, both from foreign competition and, competition from within Canada. And, not only does it basically piss off everyone else who tries to negotiate trade deals with us, and we have to give up a bunch of stuff to maintain that in those trade deals, it also just raises the cost of dairy products to the point where we pay 2 or 3 times the world average for dairy, and it's a massively regressive way to pad the pockets of 11,000 dairy farmers. So, Trump kind of has a point here on it. And, if NAFTA, it does have to get renegotiated, it'd be nice if we could, give this up for some concessions on softwood
and
lumber.
Naturally, anytime an American president mentions Canada, we all have to fuss and fawn over it. So this is, plays into, I guess, your talking points, Andrew Coyne's talking points, Maxime Bernier's, and everyone gets really passionate. I almost, the more people talk about supply management, almost the less I care. I can get it, but I can also be like...
It is one of those things that, kind of the wonky people really hate, and everybody else is meh about. Of course, I'm sure if you told them they could cut their dairy bill by two-thirds, they might change their mind, but it just doesn't really seem to be the sort of thing that's resonated with the general population.
I don't even feel like dairy is that big of a chunk of my grocery bill. Let alone.
I just hate buying $13 blots of cheese.
Fair enough. Well, and the gorilla race is on. Pat Stogren has announced his official entry into the NDP leadership race in what's been described as a pretty hilarious speech. And so I definitely need to go back and watch this. But he has managed to get a lot of attention. relative to the other candidate who's entering the race, Bruno, who got, exactly, he got an iPolitics interview, and that's still the only place that has mentioned he's in the race. But, I mean, neither of these candidates have given the $30,000 or submitted the signatures, but they both registered with Elections Canada. So I'm just excited to see what happens at the next leadership race. Although I am getting a little bit worried that what started with the NDP as actually a pretty good slate of four who could bring different ideas and present. Mm. None were super standouts, but it seemed like...
I feel like Nikki Ashton potential. Would be missed, but that might just be me on this one.
It would be bad if it was just men on the stage, for sure. So I worry that if Stogarin and Bruno come in, they could churn this a bit. I don't think either of them are going to bring in the racism of Kelly Leach or the personality of a Kevin O'Leary. So maybe I'm just preemptively oversensitive to how bad some races have gone recently for leaderships. Cough, Trump.
The conservative race is not where I thought it would be 6 months or a year ago.
But Stogren's got some interesting ideas, it sounds like. He seems to be a mix of parroting, like, traditional NDP talking points of Liberal Tory same old story, but also talking about how the NDP has spent too much time being unwilling to compromise on its values, but he seems to be wanting to double down on them at the same time. So he seems big on rhetoric, but little on policy so far. It'll be interesting to see what he actually does pitch.
Yeah, I'm admittedly looking forward to kind of seeing how him in the debates, because it could be pretty entertaining. And plus, you know, this kind of gives me an excuse to get some of that Rebel Guerrilla merchandise if we ever get some more of it back on his site. But seriously, if you haven't looked at it, you should, because it is amazing. And finally, the federal government's announced they're testing a name-blind hiring process. So when someone applies to one of the CITS departments in this program, their name gets hidden from all of the documents that get reviewed and looked at for it. And, you know, that's to, in theory, to address the issues that have come up in several studies where, you know, different names get different callback rates for the same resume.
There's pretty good evidence out there that these sort of unconscious biases we have, and it's not like overt sexism or overt racism playing a role, but just different almost criteria get used to judge resumes based on the name. So people might say, oh yeah, I value that candidate had such great education, that's why we hired him. Versus the next day it might be, oh, that candidate had such great experience, that's why we hired him. But it's almost like bends just to fit the preference. And this will happen especially if you have the face-to-face. Like, the whole hiring process is just kind of shitty at actually getting good employees. It's really just a way to, like, test, can you get along with another human being?
Which, granted, is actually a valuable job skill, but not probably the one people are ideally searching for, well, for a lot of jobs.
Most jobs don't involve, do you answer questions very well in a really stressful situation, other than maybe politician, but do we want our bureaucracy filled with politicians? So I'm really excited by this. I think it's a good idea. It's being rolled out as a pilot, and I guess that's a good way to start it, but I don't see any reason you couldn't just make it the policy of do it this way now. I mean, this has been tested in business and other places for a while.
Yeah, I quite like this idea too, and yeah, you know, I see nothing but good coming from this. And like right now there's, in the federal civil service, there's some programs out there to kind of aim at hiring certain demographic groups and whatnot. Affirmative action. And yeah, I've been a little critical of that at times in the past, as on the basis of trying to correct for implicit bias by formalizing an explicit bias in the process. And I much prefer this approach of just remove as many biases as you can rather than try and balance out the biases and hope you get it right. So, you know, this definitely strikes me as a better approach to that. And, you know, I'm excited to see what comes out of it.
Yay for the SJW Prime Minister.
And that has been Politicos. find links to the stories we mentioned in the show notes at politicalhost.ca. Make sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, or if you listen to podcasts, and follow us on Facebook and Twitter at politicalhostpod. Leave us a review and let us know what you think. And if you have any ideas for the show, feel free to send them to us. Thanks for listening.